Hey there, it's Deuce Conrad. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and I hope you were just totally stuffed with lots of great Thanksgiving treats such as turkey and whatnot. But hey, listen, the reason I'm coming to you right now is I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to every one of you, all of our fans out there across the world that listen to us every Friday, no matter what platform you may be listening to us on, whether it be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. Thank you from the bottom of my heart because you are some of the best fans ever. In the last month, we have seen astronomical growth. Over 8,000, maybe 9,000 by this point now, new followers across the spectrum. We're over 10,000 followers now on TikTok. Over 1,000 followers on Instagram, and we're nearing projectively by the end of next week, close to 1,000, if not more, on Twitter. Guys, thank you, and gals. I truly appreciate each and every one of you, and we've got a great episode lined up for you tonight as we take a trip back in time and revisit one of Huntsville, Alabama's most gruesome murders. And assaults, for that matter, as we look into the Huntsville Hatchet murders of 1998. But again, thank you guys so much for being such wonderful supporters of this show, for allowing me to be able to come into your homes, your businesses, into your lives, for that matter. And thank you for being a part of my life. Thank you for being a part of this family, my family, and allowing me to be a part of yours. It is truly a blessing to be able to do what I do. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy tonight's episode. It's been nearly 25 years since Huntsville, Alabama was shaken by the news of a gruesome murder and assault. On March the 10th, 1998, 17-year-old Jeffrey Franklin attacked his family in their home at 13005 Camelot Drive in South Huntsville. Jeffrey was armed with a hatchet, a 2-pound sledgehammer, a rat-tail file, and a butcher's knife. It was on this fateful night that he attacked his mother, Cynthia, and his father, Gerald. He also would attack his younger siblings, 14-year-old Sarah, 18-year-old Timmy, and 6-year-old Christopher. Now, Camelot Drive is a middle-class neighborhood in Huntsville, Alabama. Its lawns are kept well-manicured, and people have left their bicycles in the front lawns without fear that they would be stolen. It's your typical 1960s, 1970s style neighborhood, ranch style homes, brick homes, you name it. It's just a sense of Americana. But it was this particular winter night that the quaint neighborhood became the scene of a brutal murder. Huntsville police were alerted to the scene when a neighbor noticed one of the children laying outside the home in a puddle of blood. When they arrived, they had only come with one ambulance and one first responder vehicle, believing that, to be quite honest, they were responding to an injured child. But what they found inside, well, it distressed even the most seasoned officers, leaving a haunting memory that lasts even until today. March 10th, 1998 is a night that no one on Camelot Drive, and quite frankly, no one who was in Huntsville at the time, will ever forget. Jeffrey killed his parents and did a job on the three others that were there, says neighbor Becky Grega, in a 2008 interview with WAFF News, which is a local Huntsville news outlet. Grega lives across the street from the house that Gerald and Cynthia Franklin called home 10 years prior to the murder. She recollected and remembered the night that, well, the Franklin's oldest son, Jeffrey, used a hatchet to brutally kill his parents and slash his siblings. Gregor says that she's reminded of the grisly night every time she looks across the street. I could only imagine living across the street from such a brutal crime. It has to haunt her. She went on to say, "You think about it every day when you see the house and the images of that night. Franklin, shirtless and handcuffed, spitting, cursing, and making obscene gestures at police and news crews." Now, Jeffrey was diagnosed with ADHD before his parents were killed, and that's going to play an important role later on in this story, so you remember that. Now, when the police arrived, Jeffrey had already fled from the scene, but police issued an all-points bulletin after discovering that he had fled in a blue Geo Metro. Now, Gregory, already having committed a gruesome crime, would lead police on a car chase throughout the neighborhoods of Southeast Huntsville. It was during this chase that Jeffrey tried to run officers off of the road and succeeded at least once on Bailey Cove Road, where he forced a patrol car onto the curb in front of Hope Presbyterian Church. The chase would come to a halt when Jeffrey crashed into a fence. Now, as he was being arrested, he laughed and taunted onlookers and spat on a photographer. And despite the cold weather, Jeffrey was shirtless, and a pitchfork and pentagram had been scratched into his chest. Cynthia and Gerald were both pronounced dead at the scene, while Sarah, Timothy, and Christopher were rushed to Huntsville Hospital, where they were in critical condition. The children all had serious head and facial injuries, as one could expect from what looked like an axe and some sort of large blunt force object, said the hospital spokeswoman, Terry Bryson. Miraculously, all three siblings would survive, but as you can imagine, they had life-altering injuries, both physical and mental. Jeffrey's other sister, 11-year-old Stacy, was thankfully not at the home at the time of the attack, but in the aftermath, she would receive counseling for post-traumatic stress syndrome. And according to their aunt, Donna Maddie, they are all doing pretty good, actually. She said that she decided early on that she would not talk about what happened unless they wanted to, and then it would be on their own terms. Based on the crime scene, Jeffrey had murdered his mother first by stabbing her with a rat tail file. Now, anybody that's done any type of woodworking knows that a rat tail file is not typically something that, while it's sharp, it wouldn't be, I guess, a prime tool for a murder. Because of the way it's fabricated, I can only imagine the torture and the pain that his mother went through as he attacked her. He then attacked his sister with a hatchet, slashing her throat and clubbing her. Jeffrey then killed his father with a sledgehammer as he entered the house before turning his attention on his younger brothers. They had both been attacked with a hatchet. According to neighbors and fellow students at Grissom High School, where Jeffrey was a student, he was involved in devil worship. According to 17-year-old Jenny Smith, he was really smart, a nice person up until about 2 years prior to the murders. He just changed into a different person. I don't know why, she said. His attitude was different. He was always in a bad mood, and he had a really short temper. She described an incident during a discussion about God in their government class, which had convinced her that he worshiped the devil. Another student, Mark Dunham, said that Jeffrey often threatened to put spells on people, while Adam Sawyer said that he frequently spoke about taking drugs, mainly Ritalin. Now, a number of Cynthia's colleagues at Valley View Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center said that Jeffrey had been causing his family problems for over a year and a half. And according to one colleague, Paul Noel, she told him that it was out of hand. Cynthia told her concerned colleagues that a pastor had told her that Jeffrey was in a passing phase. But his notebook said otherwise. Police found that he had been planning on killing his parents for a while. He also wrote of satanic rituals and sexual torture and his belief that Satan wanted him to kill his family. He wrote, "I know Dad will be home at this time, and I'm going to be. I will wait by the front door behind the little hutch, and I will hit him with a hammer. Mom will be out on a walk, and when she comes back, I'll have the radio playing loudly. I'll call Mom in the room and ask her what's on the agenda for today, and then I'll kill her. And what about the brothers and sisters? Well, I'll take them. I'll strangle my little brother in his room, and I'll lure my other little brother into his room and strangle him. Then my sister, I will rape her, and I will finish her off." Even today, his writings, collected by investigators after his arrest, still have power to shock. It is something to consider. I don't even know how to begin to consider how a 17-year-old could have the capacity to commit such crimes. Where does that thought process begin? I mean, something as detailed as this. Madison County District Attorney Rob Brousser, who was then the assistant DA, prosecuted Franklin. It was a capital murder case, a death penalty case. But it never went to trial as Franklin entered a guilty plea on the eve of the trial. Brousser said, "If we didn't have this material in front of us, I think we would just have to speculate." But really, when you absorb this material, you're left with the feeling that there is evil present and that he is evil. There's a fair amount of writing having to do with kind of planning the crime and even after the crime of what he intended to do. Brousser and retired Chief Assistant DA Jim McCarty prepared for the trial in part by poring over Franklin's writings and drawings found stuffed in a speaker in his bedroom after his arrest. It was also there that Franklin's mother's body was found in that exact same room. Now, Brousser describes the writings as the contents of Franklin's head in the run-up to the murders that took place at the home on Camelot Drive. It was in this material that they found meticulous planning about how he was going to kill his parents, even tactically, the DA said. Going back to what we mentioned earlier, where he said, "I know Dad will be at home at this time, and I'm going to be. I will wait by the front door behind the little hutch," and so on and so on. He went into great detail about how he would commit these crimes, and it's pretty chilling, all the way down to, "Even if they do catch me, I will plead insanity and fool those stupid judges and prosecutors." These writings were also marked by an apparent fascination with the occult. "Devil worship based," Brousser said. "Very violent, overtones of sexual nature throughout the material. There are religious themes, sort of anti-God kind of themes that runs through it. I mean, the predominant theme here really is that of satanic worship. And as you read through this material, it's very violent," Brousser said. Retired Huntsville Police Department investigator Mac McClutchin, who would later become a state representative, handled the Jeffrey Franklin investigation. In fact, he was among the first to the crime scene. "There was just a massive amount of destruction and abuse to the family," he said. "We had another officer there, and we were trying to secure the scene, as well as get HMSI, which is the local ambulance service, and medical attention paramedics in for the kids, because the siblings were still alive." McCutchin said, "Based on the crime scene, Franklin killed his mother, Cynthia, first, stabbing her with a rat tail file. He then attacked his sister, who was 14, and with a hatchet, slashing at her throat and clubbing her. His father, Gerald Franklin, was attacked with a sledgehammer as he entered the house. Franklin's two younger brothers, around ages 9 and 6, were then attacked. Both had wounds to their throat and head injuries, apparently, from the hatchet. It was a neighbor girl that was stopping by for a visit that spotted Franklin coming out of the back door with blood on him," McCutchin recalled. "She ran home and the police were called. He never articulated anything as far as my parents. I'm tired of them nagging me. I'm tired," Brousser said of the writings. "He never articulates a reason other than One by one, they must die. Now, Franklin was spotted later that night at Ditto Landing, and it was then that he led the police in the brief chase before crashing into a family's yard in South Huntsville. McCutcheon said Franklin was shirtless and had upside-down cross markings on his torso when he was brought in for the interview. He said that Franklin was up and down in the interview, but didn't volunteer much. In fact, at one point, the investigator drew a diagram of the Franklin family's home, and McCutcheon said that he sat close to Franklin and asked him to point out where he had last seen his family members. Jeffrey then started at the house, and he took the pencil out of my hand, and he just started drawing on the paper just a circle all the way around the house, McCutcheon said. And he just went around and around and around, and then at that point, he put the pencil down, and that's when he got verbally abusive and stood up and shouted at me. It was at this point that the interview ended. Now, remember what we said earlier about ADHD? You see, it was before the murders that Jeffrey had been visiting a psychiatrist for attention deficit disorder and depression. It was there that he was prescribed with Ritalin, Prozac, and Klonopin. McCutcheon said that as part of the investigation, he learned that Franklin had likely been up for probably 3 days before the killings. Franklin had also been part of a group of teens that was abusing Ritalin. In fact, it was all Ritalin that they had been prescribed. Franklin had been given Ritalin to help control an attention deficit problem, but his dosages had been increased a number of times, according to his attorney. Robert Tootin, who represented Franklin in the run-up to his scheduled trial, said that Franklin was abusing Ritalin, snorting 3, maybe 4 pills at a time. In fact, Franklin's mother kept the pills in a lockbox, but Tootin said that Franklin had figured out how to take out the hinge pins, remove the pills, and replace them with saccharine tablets without his mother noticing. This kid was smart. This kid was very detailed in his manipulation. Now, Tootin said that a blood test done 12 days after Franklin's arrest showed 10 times the normal dose of Ritalin. Tootin said that Ritalin was a major factor in the crime. Honestly, I don't know how the kid was still alive with that much drugs in his system. Now, Jeffrey's defense attorney described his behavior as deranged. Jeffrey, in fact, told the police that he was at the house but didn't admit to attacking his family. In fact, Jeffrey said it was like some evil being had taken over his body. He would be arraigned at Madison County District Court on charges of capital murder and attempted suicide. It was there that he would initially enter a not guilty plea through his defense lawyer, Roy Miller. Well, it pushed him into total psychosis. He was crazy, Tootin said. The DA said he's familiar with the Ritalin argument. You hear Ritalin abuse, and that produces horrible result, Broussard said, and I've pondered it for 25 years, and I will admit that certain substance abuse will exasperate what is residing in somebody. He said it's not common to see drug abuse produce the results seen in the Franklin case. But I will admit it. I think it kind of greases a skid, so to speak, Broussard said. When somebody is of that nature is amped up on something, it is a bad deal. It's a powder keg. Now, along with drug abuse, Franklin's writings point to a darker side McCutcheon described as Satanism. He just felt like he was doing what Satan, who at that particular time, based on his writings, was his god, McCutcheon said, and he was doing what Satan wanted him to do. But Tootin, on the other hand, said he doesn't believe the writings prove that. I didn't think he was actually devil-worshipping, Tootin said. His family was very staunch Catholics, and I think he was doing this out of rebellion, perhaps in an effort to make his parents mad. And I don't think there's anything else to it other than that. Now, General Broussard said the writings contain a satanic and anti-God theme, along with descriptions and drawings of sexual violence. From my experience, it's unique, he said. I mean, I know this exists. I know that it's out there, but not normally do we see this connected to such a horrific series of murders. In 2001, Jeffrey avoided trial by pleading guilty to 2 murder charges and 3 counts of attempted murder. By doing so, he was sentenced to 3 life sentences that were to be served consecutively. Now, According to Jeffrey's attorneys, Robert Tootin, Patrick Tootin, and Leon Johnson, their defense would have hung on the psychiatrist's determination that Jeffrey was insane when he attacked his family. They said that they took the plea deal because it was, in all honesty, the best outcome. Just because he can stand up there in front of a judge and say yes does not mean he is all right now, said Patrick Tootin. Now, under Alabama law, a person sentenced to life in prison is eligible for parole after serving 15 years. And in fact, in September 2016, Jeffrey was denied parole. At some point after his arrest, Jeffrey became a Christian, McCutcheon said. In a statement, Jeffrey said, "I hope and pray that one day my family can forgive me for the things that I have done. And I know that may take a long time. I know that God has already forgiven me." In the statement, Jeffrey additionally warned others about the dangers of abusing Ritalin. "I told my doctor I was abusing Ritalin, but he continued to prescribe it to me in increasingly high doses, and I, in return, abused it higher and higher doses. Tootin said that Franklin was remorseful, and with drugs out of his system, he was stunned by what had happened. He said Franklin had been troubled, apparently suicidal as a teen. Franklin was under a psychologist's care before the killings and had been in a mental health unit for most of his time in prison," Tootin said. "He was a troubled teenager, and he had some deep-rooted psychological issues, some psychological problems that were probably hereditary," Tootin said. "He had sort of slipped through the cracks, and as far as being able to get the proper help, a lot of people in his life had missed some significant warning signs about his conditions." In a 2013 letter to then Madison County Judge Lloyd Little, who sentenced Franklin, Jeffrey asked that he be given credit for the 3 years he'd spent in the Madison County Jail, as the court had originally ordered. This credit would move up his parole hearing date, Franklin wrote. He added a postscript to the letter. He says, "I'm not really a bad man," he wrote. "I didn't mean to do what I did. It just happened. I have a hard time." For this part, Broussard said, for the attacks that left his parents dead, Franklin should never be released from prison. But you look at somebody who's capable of not only that, there's the 6-year-old brother, there's the 8-year-old brother, and I'm going to hack them to pieces if I can, Broussard said, and it was a miracle that they weren't killed, and one of his sisters. You think about the 3 siblings. You're the oldest in the family, and you're capable of viciously attacking your 6-year-old brother and almost killing them. That is the unfathomable to me. And look, as far as he is and as far as his spiritual well-being, I don't sit here and wish him any ill will. But that's beside the point. The point is what he's capable of and what he did, and he's exactly where he needs to be, said Broussard. It's still an unquestionable time in Huntsville's history that no one will ever forget that was in the city at that time, much less the ones that loved Jeffrey Franklin the most. Until next time, we'll see you then. Thank you for listening to the Deuce Conrad Show on Spotify Podcast. In case you didn't know, you can also hear this podcast on Google Podcast and Apple Podcast and most podcast platforms across the web. For more information about tonight's show, you can also visit www.deuceconradshow.com. Visit show notes for more details.